Our next guest, though, is on the line, so let's have the discussion. He is Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft. He's widely known as the Traveling Rabbi. He's the spiritual leader and national director of the Small Jewish Communities Association. And he put up a post on Facebook talking about the commemoration of the Entebbe raid in 2016. We're going to get into that in more detail in just a moment. What I want to do, though, is just to remind you that it was the 40th anniversary of the Entebbe raid on July the 3rd and 4th, that happened in 1976 already. Rabbi Silberhaft, thank you for being with us on Chai FM.
Hi, Simon. Good afternoon.
Just put me out of my misery, please, before we start talking all things Entebbe related. Oxtail, kosher or not kosher?
Definitely not kosher.
No way to be able to kosher it like one can do with a leg of lamb. Treif, that's it.
Well, you can treiber it in South Africa. They don't treiber. In Argentina and parts of Israel, it's called treibering, where they take out the special vein. But in South Africa, they don't do it.
Okay. All right. Good to know. So my listener was right. We had no business talking about oxtail, which we did just a short while ago. Let's move on to the much more interesting stuff, which is this commemoration. You put up, as I said, a really interesting Facebook post stating that you had been there. You were part of a delegation invited to attend in 2016. For some reason, that seems to have been a really major commemoration event. Tell me about when you think back to having been there in 2016, What comes to mind? Why was it so special?
Well, our history goes back even further than that. The African Jewish Congress, of which I'm the spiritual leader, is involved in the museum that is built at the Entebbe Airport, where the terminal building, where the raid took place. And I was invited by Charles Njonjo, the background. He was the Attorney General of Kenya at the time. And he personally signed the permission for the Israeli airplanes to fly over, first of all, to land, refuel in Kenya, and then fly over below the radar system so that they wouldn't get detected. And I met him in Kenya, in Nairobi. He took me to his house, and he still had the desk and the pen where he signed off on this raid. And we became great friends. And then in 2009, I was taken to the terminal building. And we began the idea of making it into a historic site. It was still basically a shot out, bombed out building. All the aeroplanes that the IDF destroyed the planes as they were taking off when they left. They destroyed all the Ugandan aeroplanes so that to make sure that they didn't take off and follow them and shoot them out of the sky as they were leaving with all the hostages. In 2016 was the 40th anniversary, and we were involved in erecting the big plaque that's put up on the wall, refurbishing the building, painting it up. And Netanyahu arrived, Prime Minister Netanyahu arrived with his wife, and the President Museveni was there, and he spoke. And there were a lot of delegates from around the region and a lot of people that were hostages. They flew in for the occasion, and it was a huge, hugely special occasion, should I say, to be able to stand there and commemorate such a victorious situation, a historic occasion.
I'm listening to you, and you're telling me a lot of stuff I didn't know. I found it absolutely fascinating. I had no idea that the old terminal building is now a museum. And I'm wondering, Rabbi, why on earth would the Ugandans have done that? I mean, from a Jewish perspective, I fully, totally understand why. But if you're a Ugandan, isn't it a sort of a sign of your weakness, your most inglorious moment? What was it that Museveni thought, there's something in it for me to have this a museum?
Well, the building was so shot up when they left that they couldn't use it any longer. So the Ugandans built a new airport, and this building stood for over 35 years, just derelict. And eventually the Israeli government asked them and said, can we use this building? And they said, sure, take it over. If you maintain it and you look after it, you can have it as a historic site. And you know that African countries look... Well, they used to. I don't know so much anymore with what's happening now currently in Israel, but they used to look to Israel for assistance and to be friends with Israel. And Museveni, we know, is very close to Israel even now. And so he said, sure, take it over, have it, it's yours, you can do what you want with it. And so it's fenced in, it's walled in, and that building today is a museum. It's, you can't get to it easily, you have to get, it's obviously a security, tightly security guarded. But in fact, in my office, I have pieces of glass from the windows that were shot out as they arrived, when they arrived, if you watch the movie, you'll see that they arrived, and they, as they came in, they started to shoot through the glass doors and saying in Hebrew, we are the Israelis, you know, and the terrorists didn't know what they were saying, and the Israelis, all the Jews all fell to the floor, and the terrorists remained standing, and they shot them. And that's how they neutralized the terrorists.
It's really, really interesting that you mention that, because I just happened to have seen on the weekend a Times of Israel documentary where they talk about one Israeli who didn't obey. I wish I could remember his name. I don't. He was a 19 or 20 year old. He didn't hit the floor as he should have, and he was killed by friendly fire. And it's really fascinating, right? Because we think about Yoni Netanyahu. We all know his name, the hero that he was. We all know Dora Bloch, who was killed in hospital on the orders of Idi Amin. But we don't know the names of the other casualties, and there were Jewish casualties. I mean, I know it doesn't fit the narrative of the heroic raid.
There were two, others. And I think, I know for a fact their bodies, their remains eventually were brought to Israel and buried there.
Quite something.
After Idi Amin, his power, you know, after his power came to an end, the country eventually relinquished their remains.
Back in
just out of interest, there was go ahead.
You go ahead.
Just out of interest, that there was a Jewish community there going back to the 1930s, 1940s, and together with Janice Masur, who was born there in Uganda, we've actually erected a plaque, a huge plaque, a massive plaque, 2 meters by 4 meters large, telling the history of Ugandan Jewry.
Wow.
Because the small Jewish cemetery, there was once a Jewish cemetery, and once all the Jews left, the government allowed a block of flats and a shopping center to be built over the Jewish cemetery. And we don't know exactly where the Jewish graves are today, but we have a list of the Jewish graves. And so we've erected a big monument plaque with a history of all these Jewish names, of the people buried there, as well as all the Jewish people that lived in the country at the time until the 1970s, before this happened.
Goodness gracious me, we really did get to the oddest places. Uganda, of all places.
Yeah, absolutely. Jews were everywhere.
Crazy, 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 crazy. You were there in 2016. Anne Harris, the late chief rabbi's wife, was there with you. She has been quoted as having mentioned the mitzvah of freeing the captives, Pidyon Shvuim, as being the central tenet of the raid. And I'm just wondering, as a rabbi, was that an important moment for you in Jewish history, not just politically, but say spiritually as well?
Absolutely, 100%. It was very, very vital. You got to understand that the people, first of all, we understand that one of the main reasons that it was a success was, besides that, God Almighty was with them. And we know that even once the planes left Israel, they still didn't know if they're going to go into Uganda or not. They were in the air, and they knew that they may get instructions to turn around. And only once they were quite far did they get the decision, get the command to say, go in and actually action what you had to do. And they stayed over at the Norfolk Hotel. I don't know if you know about that. It belonged to Mr. Block. And once the terrorist organization found out about it later, they actually bombed the hotel because he allowed the air crew to stay over at his hotel free of charge. But that's something else. But the airport was actually built by a Jewish-led company, and they had the plans for it. And that's what made part of the rescue that much more successful.
And here we're sitting in 2026, where Israel is the South Africa of the world in terms of loathed and reviled. And it just somehow takes us back to an easier, simpler time where she was just merely heroic. I mean, it really was heroic.
Absolutely. And we wish that we had that stamina and that faith to be able to go in again and do what we have to save our people. We're not going to talk about 7th of October and the hostages, how long it took to save them.
No, we're not. We've done that ad nauseum. I'm looking at the time. It's 27 past. I've got 3 minutes to go.
Right.
And it just so happened that a listener sent me a WhatsApp talking about your new book launch. And I thought maybe you'd just give us a sneak peek into this book that is going to be released pretty soon.
Yes, so the first launch is in Cape Town on this Sunday, and then there's two more launches, one with Mandy Wiener on the 15th in Sandton, exclusive books this coming Wednesday, the 15th at 6:30, and then at the Chief Rabbi Harris Center on Sunday, the 26th. It's my second book. My first was the Traveling Rabbi, My African Tribe, and it's basically not about me. It's about the people that I meet. The devotion that the people that I meet, how they devote themselves keeping Judaism alive. And it also reflects the challenges that they have and how together we have overcome many, many challenges that people in Johannesburg find so easy to, as Batya said in her interview, you know, you need a kichel and heri, you can go down to Kosher World and you can get it. Or you need a minion, you've got 300 minyanim in Glen Hazel. But in the country communities, you can't get a carrot, you can't get a yahrzeit candle, or you can't get, you know.
So give me one example. Concretize this for me. Like, what's the most way out, weird and wacky story that you have put in the book?
There are many, many stories.
Pick one.
Well, as I said to Batya the other day, that I had a call from a man in Camos who moved there recently, and he's 93 and a half years old, and he speaks a fluent Yiddish, and he hasn't spoken Yiddish for a long time. I met him, and when I called to say I'm coming to see him, what can I bring him? He said he wants kichel and herring and gefilte fish, and that for him, he sat there crying, and we spoke Yiddish for 2 hours. He loved it. He absolutely loved it. He put on a yarmulke and we chatted and we laughed. Slowly he'll get closer. The point is that for him, he came from Shadava, and he just absolutely was in his element. We got to understand that the people in the country communities are not as close and involved as the people, and they don't have the facilities that people in Johannesburg and Cape Town have. And so we can't judge them by saying, oh, well, you know, they don't daven three times a day and they don't have long beards and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But for them, a lot of it, that's their Yiddish God. Give them an Israeli flag. Give them a Jewish calendar, as I always say, a Yahrzeit calendar. And for that, for them, is total connection.
Rabbi, we're going to leave it there. We're out of time. I want to wish you best of luck with the book. I hope we all go out and buy a copy. Thanks for chatting to us at Chai FM on this really important issue of commemorating the Entebbe raid.